I'll try to do better.
No, that's good.
You're listening to Please Be Reasonable, where we seek to speak humbly and passionately about things that matter and things that don't.
Hello, hello, and welcome to Please Be Reasonable. I'm your co-host, Sam.
And I'm your co-host, Josh.
What up, my dude? Do you like that? I'm trying that out. I did that last episode, too.
Is that
instead of saying Josh, I'm like, what up, my dude?
Is that hip pastor speak in 2018?
I don't think that's cool in any setting.
So here we are, episode 20.
Yeah.
I guess we're like...
21.
That's got to make us legit.
This is episode 21.
Oh, my note says 20. But hey, either way, man, we are in the dodeca digits.
We're in the vientes. Oh, man. I have a question for you.
Yes.
Do you remember, this is a evangelical Christian subculture question. Do you remember when we were in high school?
Definitely.
And there was a youth group video that went around, made its rounds on all the youth groups on Wednesday nights. And it was like this edgy, like poetry thing with this girl talking about the woman at the well. She was like, to be known is to be loved, and to be loved is to be known.
No, I don't remember that.
You don't remember that? You are the first youth group kid. I remembered that video the other day. I was sitting working on stuff for church, writing, doing some creative planning. And I remember that video, and I was like, oh, man, I remember that. I wonder if that still exists. So I found it on YouTube. And then I started asking people about it. Literally every person I've asked who's like a youth group kid is like, oh yeah, I remember that video. My youth pastor showed it like a couple times. And so I've been like, this is crazy. Like there was this point in like youth group culture where this video had become youth pastor viral. And it was like working its way through youth groups. You don't remember it at all.
We must have just been just on the outer edge of that youth group network.
Well, can I play an audio clip from it and you see if you recognize it?
Sure.
Can we do this?
Yeah. I remember the video to the Lifehouse song of the girl that was what did they call those? Performance video. I forget what there was a name for it.
They couldn't be called like dancing because of conservative churches.
It was like a genre of art of theater.
Yeah, there's so
what do they call
weird.
Those things?
I know what you're talking about.
Skit. Living video?
Yeah, no, living video. That was it.
I thought
living
it was video. Like a I heard something skits or something. You know, that was a powerful video, man. That one bring tears to my eyes, man.
This.
Serious.
This video. This is it.
You whisper as I pass by and cast judgmental glances, though you don't really take the time to look at me or even
you don't remember
to
this?
Know
me for. No. To be known is to be loved, and to be loved is to be known, and otherwise what's the point?
Well, I can't finish it because the reason I started to tell you this is like I had this realization where everyone's like, I remember that. So I go back and I watch it just because I'm like on this weird memory lane thing. And I like cried like a little baby watching this video. I was like, oh, it's so beautiful to be known and be loved. Jesus loves you. And it was just like, what the heck is going on right now? But you totally ruined it because you never saw it. I was like so ready for you to be like, yeah, I saw that. I remember it. But you didn't. So
blew it. Yeah. Sorry.
It's all good. So what are we talking about tonight?
We are talking about the moral decay of America.
Yeah, if there's any other topic conservative Christians enjoy talking about, it's how Americans are going down the toilet, morals-wise.
1777.
Yeah, going to hell in a handbasket and making it cool since the American Revolution, America.
But first...
Do we have a dino segment?
Well, no. Hold. But first, we have a listener comment.
Ooh, we have listeners?
Yeah. Well, they're related to me, but...
Oh, we have listener comments that's not my mom?
My brother, Steven, texted me, said, bro, just heard Sam say on the podcast, I haven't seen you in a hot minute. And I was like, I don't get that phrase. And then you said, I don't get that phrase. Like, we're related or something.
So, really quick, because I've heard this from a couple of people.
Yeah.
Did I just make that up? Is that not a real phrase?
No, I've heard other people use it.
Oh, okay.
But,
because I have some isms I know that I've just made up. No. But I thought that was a real one.
Yeah, I mean, it's out there.
But
I just don't get it.
I get comments on it a lot.
Yeah.
It's been a hot minute and since I've gotten a comment.
Also, the same week, what are the odds? My brother Zach texted me.
How many brothers do you have?
Well, I do have like four. He said, I enjoyed the Going Green episode.
That's it?
Well, he said, he said some more stuff, but I'm not going to go into it all because I didn't get his consent to share everything.
Gotcha. Well, that's awkward.
Yeah.
Do you want to text him right now and see if he can share it, and then we'll cut this part out?
No, it's cool.
Okay.
But no, we just talked about the tension between trying to go green and then, like, fly home from Australia.
Yeah.
And burn lots of carbon fuel.
Yeah.
Because he's living in Australia right now.
Well, can you just do what Shane Claiborne does and get people commit to walk and not drive their cars while he's gone to offset it?
Yeah. So anyway,
speaking of global warming, it's been beautiful this week in St. Louis.
Yes,
I love it.
I've been outside.
Unseasonably warm for January.
Not too unseasonably.
Really?
Only 50s.
It was 60 something today, and it was 70 earlier this week on Monday.
Yeah.
In January, that seems unseasonable to me. Maybe I'm crazy.
Yeah.
I got my bicycle out, man. I pulled it Headland and I biked around.
Yes. Bowling. Good job. Going green.
I offset it by driving my Suburban later to make up for it. So I didn't even drive it. I just went out in the driveway and turned it on, left it running.
Well, that's part of that moral decay thing.
Oh, man. Well, in the same realm of listener feedback, we do have a dino segment, which is based on a listener question.
Yes.
Oh, man. That's what I get from not planning stuff.
It's a dinosaur.
So a couple weeks ago, we put out a tweet and we said, hey, we're recording tonight. Do you have any questions? And our friends, the Hollands, is that right? The
Hollands? Who are a band that is awesome folk music with a little bit of Australian influence.
Ooh.
That you should definitely check out.
They got back to us, but we didn't see it till after we finished recording. And so we put that question in our pocket to talk about it now.
So the
question, what's up, Hollands? Why are you playing Australian music, but you're named after Holland?
Well,
is that a question you hear a lot? Is that really dumb? I'm sorry, Hollands.
I'm sorry, Hollands. He means well.
Josh is like, you're embarrassing me in front of my friends.
So the question was, if dinosaurs existed today, would humans have domesticated them by now? And what role would they play in our everyday life?
Oh, heck yes.
You think so, Sam?
No, I don't.
You don't think so, Sam?
No. I've been to the Science Center. I've seen that big old robot Tyrannosaurus Rex.
Okay, well, yeah. I mean, okay, so T-Rex, no. But you have to remember, there's a huge diversity to dinosaurs. Like, all the way down to tiny ones and all kinds of different kinds. And so I think we would have, like, if you compare them to, like, reptiles today, or maybe a little bit like birds today.
Yeah.
Like, people have pet turtles, pet lizards.
Weird pet, people.
Like, semi, I mean, they're not your top five animals, but,
they're not cuddly enough.
But some people like them, and dinosaurs are so cool that people would definitely try to have some of them as pets, I think.
I don't think it would be a pet thing, though. I think we would domesticate them for practical use.
Like using T-Rexes to, like, churn up, irrigate soil or something?
Oh, no, I was going to say, like, covering them in armor and sending them into battle.
Ride ankylosaurs for armored battle or something?
I don't know. I feel like if humans are good at anything, it's subjugating lesser species to their benefit.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I mean,
I think if.
Like Genghis Khan riding nodosaurs instead of horses or something.
Well, my whole thing is, if you go back over human history and how humanity has spread over Earth and what it has done with the Earth, with its dominion and power and those things, I'm pretty sure humans would have either domesticated or wiped out dinosaurs.
Yeah, I mean, the question is if they existed today. So, like, are we precluding the possibility of humans wiping them out?
Well, no.
Are we saying, like, if they were still around, we would be wiping them out?
What I mean by that is, like, okay, So, for instance, mountain lions in our area in the Midwest, those are like a pretty alpha predator. Like, they're a pretty big dog. Apex predator, I guess, is the word. But we've mostly wiped them out, so they're endangered. But then there are other things like house cats, you know, that are the same mm-hmm. family, and we're like, oh, we've domesticated them. And so I feel like we would have hunted the ones that were dangerous and domesticated mm-hmm. the ones that were useful. Like, you know, did you see Last Jedi?
Not yet.
You haven't seen Last Jedi yet?
Nope.
There's this big lizard thing on the beach, and Luke Skywalker yeah. milks it.
So I've heard. Spoiler alert.
How is that a spoiler?
Well, the other thing I was thinking about is, so like...
Might spoil your
we
happiness.
We all think dinosaurs are super cool, but I wonder if like they were around, especially like more normal, the more normal sized ones, like would we think they were, like, is part of their cool factor just that they're extinct?
And yeah.
We don't actually, like, would they be less cool if they're running around? Like, if you think about it, like, a squirrel could be this like amazingly awesome, funny looking thing, but because there's a million of them running around my house all the time trying to get into my attic, I hate them.
Yeah.
But if I'd never seen one before, maybe I'd think they were cool.
There was a TV show. Did you watch cartoons when you were little?
Yeah, a few.
So
there were a few that were not on the banned list.
When we were like really little, Fox 2, back when Fox was... No, Fox. Back when Fox was Channel 30. Fox 30.
Back when you had the TV, you had to yeah. turn the dial.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They had these Saturday morning cartoons, and there was like... the X-Men cartoon, and there was Eek the Cat, and then there was this other cartoon, and I can't remember what it's called, but the whole premise of it was that if dinosaurs stayed on Earth and became the dominant species instead of humans, and so it was like a modern city, and like humans and mammals were like the nuisance species, but like dinosaurs were the people, and it was really funny and interesting. That's all I can say about it. I can't.
I used to play the Sega Genesis game with my cousin called Dinosaurs for Hire.
Yeah. I played that game with you. Dinos for Hire.
I'm not sure what that has to do with any of this.
Well, it's dinosaurs with machine guns, which is what would happen if dinosaurs still existed in 2018.
But yeah, I definitely think there would be some attempts, but probably not all of them.
You can't tame the wild free spirit of a plesiosaur.
I mean, no.
Well, let's move on.
Let's move on. .org.
So anyway, the moral decay of America. If there's anything, I said it before, I'll say it again. If there's anything I feel like American conservative Christians love harping on, if there's any soapbox that we can just go on for hours, it's that America is going down the toilet. All our morals and ethics are terrible.
We used to follow God, founded on Christian values.
Yeah, and now look at us. We've got the Kardashians and reality television.
We've got violence on TV, no prayer in schools, abortion.
Yeah.
People having all kinds of sexual debauchery.
Sex out of marriage and playing cards, Pokemon cards, summoning demons.
Watching TV shows with...
cuss words.
And...
I feel like we're being a little patronizing at this point.
Oh, yeah, okay. Let's tone it down. Let's make it a little reasonable. But yeah, like, I totally grew up with the whole just paradigm.
Yeah.
That things were not only that things were getting worse and moral decay, but things were expected to get worse and continue to get worse until the eschaton.
Ooh.
Is that the right word to use?
Ooh, look at that.
And basically until the rapture.
Yeah.
And the initiation of all the parts of Revelation that we interpreted the way we did.
You know, it's interesting the way it was talked about in my home, the way I remember it being talked about in my home. I feel like I should preface things that way more often because I was a little kid remembering these things. But the way I remember it being talked about in my home was that, yes, like the country's morals are getting worse and worse and worse. And we should expect that as we get closer and closer to the rapture and Armageddon. But it is the Christian's duty to fight to rebuild a Christian nation. Like my family was involved in some of like the moral majority stuff. And like, I remember like my parents were really politically active and really socially active. Like I have like a vivid memory of going and holding up protest signs at a Planned Parenthood once when I was like seven. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah. There's definitely that aspect too. It was kind of like this, they kind of like coexisted though. It was like,
yeah,
the world's going to hell in a handbasket, but.
And there's nothing like, you can do about it, but we should all fight to make it a Christian nation again.
Yeah. Or at least give it our best shot or something.
What I think is interesting, and I think this is probably the reason we chose to talk about this tonight, is it seems like there's been this major flip on that perspective in the last 5-10 years. Like something, I might be like way oversimplifying this, Josh, so please push back on this. But it seems like the sort of conversations that were going on in the 90s surrounding the necessity of morality in politics and social structure and social discussions, like in the Clinton era, like it was really intense, right? Like I remember in my church circle and in my family circle having conversations about how, of course, Bill Clinton's sexual ethics affect his ability to be an excellent leader, and that we should hold him to account for his moral decisions as a political and social leader. And then once we kind of transitioned into the Obama era and now into the Trump era, it seems like that's kind of reversed. And it seems like more of the Christians are the ones arguing like, well, he doesn't have to be an ethical person as long as he's advancing the right social agenda.
Yeah, well, yeah, there's the same underlying culture war mentality of the state of America.
Culture war, I like that.
But there's also a growing divide between our parents' generation and our generation, mm-hmm, in how we view all that.
Yeah.
And so, I don't know. I have some thoughts that I just want to lay out and see what you think about all this stuff. Like, so part of why we wanted to talk about this is because in the last few months, there's been a big, you could say, awakening, I guess, in our culture regarding sexual harassment,
yeah,
and abuse by a lot of powerful people in different industries and facets of the country. A lot of people being outed and removed from various positions and different things.
Yeah.
I
just have to say really quick, because we're talking about like a lot of like the Me Too movement and Time's Up movement and stuff like that. Did I tell you my insanely embarrassing story about when the Me Too hashtag started?
No, do you want to?
I do. It's like really embarrassing, but it's one of those things where I need to confess it and get it off my chest.
All right.
So I didn't know what it was. Like, mm-hmm, when people started using it, I wasn't, for whatever reason, when all that started to go down, that was a season when I wasn't really reading the news. And by coincidence, I popped on Facebook to post something through our church's site. And this guy I know back in the day had posted something really vague, but used the hashtag MeToo. Mm-hmm. And I had no idea what it meant. And I was looking at his post and I thought he was being innocuous, because this guy usually is kind of goofy in jokes or whatever. And so I put this like really sarcastic comment back to it with the hashtag, and then was like, that's funny. And I posted it. And then I like scrolled past it and like realized what the hashtag was, and I was like, oh no, what have I done? So I like go back to it and I couldn't figure out how to delete the stupid comment. And I was like on my phone trying to figure it out. And so then I was like, I finally like posted another comment below it, and I was like, dude, I'm really sorry. I didn't know what that meant. I hadn't read the news. I'm an idiot. I put my foot in my mouth. And so then I like run to the other room, because the guy texts me and he's like, dude, you need to use your computer to delete the comment because you're on your phone. I like run in the other room and open up my laptop and like get on, delete the comment, blah 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 blah. Anyway, it was really embarrassing.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, were you surprised at all by the amount of, or the level of number of things that have come out?
No, I really wasn't. and I can talk about the nuance of a couple of the reasons why for that. I was not surprised by the amount. I was surprised by the way different segments of our society responded to it. And this may sound cynical, but like, I mean, I've been a pastor for a decade, and a lot of people open and confess and come to pastors for counsel. And so the sheer amount of sexual brokenness and abuse that goes on in our culture, like, that wasn't shocking to me. Mm-hmm. What was shocking to me was the fact that people like resisted it, that people didn't welcome this outing in this cultural change. Like, that was, and especially some of the ways some of the church responded to it and was slow to move and slow to speak on stuff it shouldn't have been.
Yeah. And I thought, yeah, I definitely want to talk about some of that. Like, I feel like, well, I wasn't surprised either. Like, I saw people make comments of like women saying, "Oh, I can't believe all you men are surprised that, well, we've been trying to tell you forever that there's all this harassment going on." I had read this book called Everyday Sexism, like last year, by somebody named Laura Bates, who she had started sharing stories and it kind of became viral. She made a book out of it. And it goes into just all these different ways that women sharing stories of being harassed, abused, discriminated against.
Yeah.
And I felt like the book kind of conflated a little bit, like some different kinds of things that I would distinguish a little bit between, like, workplace type, like, discrimination, like power structure stuff, and then just like guys being brutes and crude, like terrible people basically on the subway or whatever, which, like, I would kind of distinguish, like the first one, there's a good debate to be had about the role of, like, Christian patriarchy in fostering, like, discriminatory attitudes, but then also a role of, like,
that's like a whole,
but that's a whole,
yeah,
but then, like, other aspects I would feel like those people aren't behaving like Christians.
Yeah.
But I mean, I get that there's like still a good argument to be had about, like, what role negative aspects of Christian culture can have in perpetuating attitudes and stuff, but I'm not really qualified to talk about all that right now. But what I found interesting about it all was, okay, so, like, there's a whole paradigm of, like, moral decay is getting worse and worse in our country. And I heard this guy named Carl Ellis, who is in our church's Presbyterian denomination. He was, like, one of the first ordained African Americans in the denomination, which has been historically, like, super white. And he shared at this talk once about how a lot of African American Christians have kind of an opposite view, where they view America as becoming more and more Christian.
Yeah.
Because, like, some of our cultural heroes of Jonathan Edwards, or I forget, George Whitefield, did he own slaves?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
There was, like, you know, like, a lot of, like, we look, quote from them in certain ways and look at them as, like, heroes of the culture. But to him, like, they owned slaves. Like, how, like, that, they couldn't even be, like, honorable Christians because of that behavior to him.
Yeah.
And then,
do you remember that propaganda song from a couple years ago? Precious Pure Ones. Yeah.
That was good. And so, but then, like, you know, slavery gets abolished in the 1800s. And then you still have forms of discrimination and racism. And then you have further progress, civil rights in the 60s. And all these things where, and in some of those things, the church played a role in the abolition movement, in the civil rights movement, Martin Luther King, and, like, there was
ending child labor, and
even though there were even though there were Christians that were defending those things, there was also a very, like, strong Christian element trying to overcome those things, seeing, like, hey, like, this is love your neighbor as yourself, like, you know, these are wrongs, terrible things, and we need to fix them. And so, like, in those ways, a lot of things are better now than they used to be. And so, like, the Me Too movement, I feel like, kind of is in a similar vein of, like, there's a lot of ways that powerful men have abused their positions for sexual favors and harassment that now society is saying, we're not going to tolerate that anymore. And so that's like a way of morals getting better. But I feel like, my theory is that, like, there's a lot of ways in which our, like, personal morality has gotten farther from traditional Christian values mm-hmm. in our culture. But, like, interpersonal values have gotten more Christian.
Okay.
Like, back in the 1800s, you had people going to church and being all pious, but then owning slaves. And then, like, now you have people doing all kinds of things that are considered unbiblical and immoral. But at the same time, there's all these interpersonal relationships, things, people hurting each other that we're not tolerating anymore, saying that's wrong, that's essentially sinful.
Yeah.
But then at the same time, something that's interesting, so, I mean, I don't really know what to make of that, but it's just kind of interesting. But then at the same time, I feel like the church had a historical role in, like, some of the previous interpersonal moral gains with slavery, the civil rights movement. But, like, this Me Too movement has been, like, not driven by the church. Yeah. It's been driven by, like, feminism and, like, other social movements. And the church has even been kind of, like, resisting it
yeah.
in a lot of ways and kind of on the wrong side of it.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I think that's interesting. I don't know.
Yeah. When the hashtag started going, there was the one that jumped up alongside it, like the hashtag church too. And people started, like, sharing stories of abuse within the church and how they experienced, like, dehumanization and objectification within the context of the church. And most major Christian leaders have been, for the most part, silent about it. And mm-hmm. I say most in the way of, like, yeah, people have put out statements or, like, tweeted things or whatever, but, like, it's not getting the play in church circles.
Yeah, well, and you had...
The way it's getting anywhere else.
Well, you had the Senate special election in Alabama last fall
mm-hmm.
with the Republican candidate facing accusations of abuse and harassment. And he ended up getting basically doubling down on his support from conservative Christians from it.
Yep.
While Hollywood was outing and, like, completely, like, rejecting Harvey Weinstein and people like that.
Yeah.
And it's so it's like, you know, I just think it's ironic that, like, we grew up being told that, like, Hollywood was, like, this bastion of, like, moral decay, like, this liberal
cesspool.
Yeah, like, just, like, destroying the moral fabric of America. And it's now, the
Obi-Wan line. Never has there been a more vile den of scum and villainy or whatever.
Usually I see people quote that about Congress. But now, like, Hollywood is the one raising the standards, saying we're not tolerating this stuff anymore. While a lot of the church is, like, covering for it. Exactly. All I was saying was, like, some people would push back and say, oh, they thought there were good reasons for doubting those accusations. They're politically motivated, etc. in Alabama. But I thought it was just a stunning contrast.
And I know, like, I know a lot of this was, like, politicking, right? Like, the two, I mean, I don't trust either of the major political parties in any way whatsoever. But at the same time, it was frustrating to see the president and the Republican Party doubling down on Roy Moore where there seemed to be at least credible enough accusations that they needed to be worked out by a third party, while like stuff comes up with Al Franken and they're just like, yeah, you need to resign, and he resigns. You know what I mean? Yeah. It was just like,
there were even like officials in Alabama saying, even if it was true, well, we still support him because we,
yeah,
like Mary was a, Joseph Murray was a teenager.
Like, oh my gosh. Don't yeah.
get me started on that. And then like even more recently, like there's been stories about the president having an affair with a porn star.
Yeah.
10 years ago and being paying money to keep it out of the news.
Yeah.
And like Tony Perkins saying, oh, Trump gets a mulligan on that one because yeah, no one's perfect.
Gosh.
And Franklin Graham saying, well, he's been truthful to me, or I think he's been truthful or something like that.
But I mean, this is going to sound really cynical, but is that in the least bit surprising with how Trump has presented himself morally for the last 7 months?
Yeah, it's just
like when that story broke, and this speaks to my own probably just numbness, but I remember being like, okay, is it?
Yeah, like, no, like that doesn't surprise me. But what frustrates me is the continued like defense and justification that yeah. is still coming.
Yeah.
From the,
especially in light of what I said at the beginning, that if you backtrack to Clinton era,
yeah,
these same evangelical leaders were touting that these moral failures were evidence of lack of an ability to be a political yeah. leader.
They're like, you couldn't separate
someone's morals from their politics.
Yeah, because it, like someone of without moral character literally can't make good decisions
yeah.
to be a good leader. And now saying, well, it doesn't matter whatever Trump's done in his personal life because he's defending our values. And I've never heard him tell a lie.
Oh, man.
Like,
I feel like we're both like so much in the same camp here. You know what I mean? Like we're mentally, yeah. we're in the same space that I feel like we might not be representing the thought process well. And I actually think that's important, especially going back to, you know, our whole reason for existing as a show. But I have these sorts of conversations with church folk often about Trump and Trumpism, right? And how that connects to Christianity and Christian ethics and those things. And while I may not personally agree with the thought process that goes behind some of these Christian Trump supporters, I understand it to some extent, at least going back to the election, right? Like the continued like diehard support of Trump is a little harder for me to wrap my head around, but I can see a utilitarian understanding of Trump to say, I don't like him. I don't like his morals or his ethics, but he's better than Hillary and he'll accomplish these things that I think are important. And I mean, he's appointed a massive amount of conservative judges to long positions.
Yeah.
And so that's the thing I keep hearing back from my Christian friends who are utilitarian about it, where they're going, well, no, yeah, like Trump's kind of embarrassing. I don't agree with him ethically, but his impact of appointing these judges in the long term of our country is going to have a more kingdom-centric impact than his personal failures and his, you know, jerkiness or whatever it is. And I get that. I tend to default to a more utilitarian view of the world personally. And so I understand how someone could arrive at that. I guess I just don't personally agree with it, you know?
Yeah.
But I also like, I don't want to disrespect that. And I don't want to dismiss that. We know people who've been really thoughtful and seen their support of Trumpism and like the Trump presidency as like an expression of their Christian conviction. Yeah. You're like, I can't say anything to that.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, you can say, oh, we, you know, all you go back, presidents have always been morally questionable. If you knew everything they'd all done, and now we just hear everything Trump says and does, but he's doing the things that the values that they agree with, and
What is, really quick, because you know more about politics than I do, Josh. Aside from the judges, what has Trump done that would make conservative evangelical Christians happy? Like thinking about that, like moral majority political platform, what sort of stuff has he fought for?
Well, I think mostly just stuff that would align more with conservative political stuff that a lot of conservative Christians believe is best for the economy and for, you know,
trickle down economics.
Yeah, cutting regulations.
Cut regulation.
And limiting
immigration.
Yeah, tighter immigration to, you know, fewer Muslims coming in.
See, that one, yeah, that one I've heard a lot. I guess in my
mind.
Which
we did a whole episode on that, so yeah. You know where we stand if you go to episode 5 or 6.
Yeah, exactly. I guess in my mind, I mentally associate the Christian political platform more with, like, the traditional discussion of pro-life and abortion and those things. And it just, I mean, I feel like, has Trump done much about that? Like, is that even much of a discussion?
I mean,
he's like, doesn't he want to defund Planned Parenthood or something? Or is that other guys?
I don't know, maybe. I mean, essentially comes back to the judges. Like,
the judges is the thing. Conservative judges. Yeah. Constitutionalist judges.
The judges will limit abortion. Will rule against abortion on cases.
Yeah.
And that's like the number one most important thing.
Man, I am, and I want to be really clear about this. Like, I try really hard to be humble and open specifically about politics, because I know that's an area that I am woefully, I don't understand that world. I don't understand the world of public policy. Like, I'm a pastor. I think in terms of small groups of people, and I think in terms of soul care and things like that. And so honestly, politics is like a hard, large scale social structure is a hard mental shift for me. And so I know that I'm naive in the world of politics, so I try and be open to this kind of stuff, but I just don't see it. I just don't see it. I don't see Jesus in those things, in most of those platforms.
Yeah, well, like, I'll take the other side on that a little bit. Like, you could say that, like, most of what Jesus argued for was personal compassion, but it's not supposed to be the government doing it, and there's certain things around immigration that we have to limit to defend our whole civilization, and, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I just don't see it. Yeah. I just don't see it. And I'm not trying to be bullheaded about that and be like, oh, if you don't agree with me, then you don't love Jesus. Like, that's not what I'm trying to say at all. I just can't see it. I hear people explain that stuff to me, and I'm like, yeah, it just doesn't seem like the Jesus I see in scripture. It doesn't seem like the Christianity I want to be a part of. Maybe I'm wrong. What do I know?
Something else I wanted to mention. We talked a little bit about Andy Savage.
Yeah, yeah.
So, like, I've seen, so just on the whole, like, response of people to a lot of the recent stuff, like, I've seen some conservative types speaking up, saying that this whole thing shows the brokenness of secular culture because they have no paradigm for redemption.
Mm-hmm.
That all they can do is completely shame and destroy someone's career for something they did, and then they're done.
Yeah.
And there's no, like, paradigm for redemption.
Yeah.
That we have in Jesus Christ. And then I've seen people on the other side criticizing, like, the church response, and specifically, like, Andy Savage thing, saying that the church's obsession with forgiveness and redemption totally minimizes the severity of pain and abuse, and like, oh, the church applauded the guy. Oh, you know, good, you've owned up, you're forgiven, but totally like not recognizing the consequences and the harm on the woman involved, and
which
like,
really
just
quick,
papering over like,
yeah. If you don't know the story, so Andy Savage was the pastor at High Point Church in Nashville. And the thing about him that's running around the internet is he had an honest discussion, honest with air quotes on it, discussion with his church body about sexual abuse that he engaged in as a youth pastor with a minor who was one of his students at a previous church. And his church stood up and applauded him when he like brought this confession. And so like that clip of that like has gone viral, and people have used that as like ammunition to show how the church doesn't care about the victim and only cares about, you know, covering up and hiding abusers who are in power, which just feeds into a larger cultural narrative about the church that started when, you know, the Catholic sex abuse scandal started to break out. But I do have to say, like, just because I have to say this, it's so frustrating to me. Obviously, the viral video is out of context. So you should look up, Ed Stetzer did a great breakdown on this.
I tend to like Ed Stetzer.
Yeah.
He's Christianity Today.
Yeah, he's editor. The head of the, he's a pastor at Moody Church in Chicago, and he's the head of the Billy Graham Association, Billy Graham Chair at Wheaton College. He ran Lifeway Research forever, but he did an article, a really good breakdown on it, where he basically talked about how Savage and his church handled the whole thing terribly. And the whole thing of it comes down to, you know, so he was, what, 21, 22, and she was 17, and they were in Tennessee. And at that time, like, that wasn't, like, that could be a legal consensual sexual relationship. And the way the church handled it was awful, but there wasn't any technical laws broken or whatever, so he didn't ever have any charges filed against him.
But it wasn't a legal thing. It was more abuse of power and privilege.
Abuse of power, yeah. But when he this is what frustrates me, when he shared it with his church, he shared it in such a way that was so vague and left out so much information that it makes total sense in context why his church applauded him. Because the way he shared it was basically like, hey, I want to get ahead of this. I want to let you guys know, man, back when I was younger and like I was in, you know, in a more rural church and there wasn't a lot of like health or accountability, that I had this sexual failing and there was an incident, but you know, it was brought to the attention of the elders and the family was involved and there was full resolution and we moved on in a gospel way. And I just want you guys to know that about me. And so his church is like, man, that's awesome. Like, you confess this thing and you had a failing, but we trust that you're telling us the truth, that this was worked out and things were brought to the light and there was real reconciliation and real consequences. And so they cheer for him. And as the story has come out in further detail, like, it's not what went down. Like, he coerced a 17-year-old girl into a sexual relationship. And then the church leadership pressured her family into not seeking to like damage his character or his reputation. And he never sought, like, he never even spoke to her again, much less like apologized or sought reconciliation or owned any consequences. Like, the whole thing was a massive abuse of power and like wasn't handled well, but he didn't choose to communicate that in the moment when the applauding happened. And what Stetzer
does, would be seen as furthering all the same problems that allowed in the first place.
Exactly. What Stetzer does is he compares how Savage's church handled it to how Austin Stone Community Church handled it, because the senior pastor who was over Andy Savage at the time is now one of the associate pastors at Austin Stone, which is a really large church down in Texas, and basically talks about how the second the story broke, they put him on administrative leave. And they're like, you need to step away from your position and step down from eldership until we do a impartial third-party investigation and come to a decision. Like, it's not a dig on you. We just don't know. And so you need to step down and step away until we know. And just talking about the seriousness with which Austin Stone took the accusation versus the seeming flippancy and dismissiveness that High Point took the accusation. And I think that's a really, really clear picture of some of the disconnect and how the church is engaging this whole movement and this social change concerning power dynamics and sexual mm-hmm. harassment and those things.
Yeah, I feel like there's truth to the critique that like the kind of no tolerance, no redemption thing is empty. That we've all done things, or we all may do things that we would not want to be completely ostracized from society forever for doing, and that there is a beauty in the role of redemption that Christianity has. Yeah. But then at the same time, I also feel like that is often abused and simplified to completely paper over like the actual consequences that have to be dealt with.
Yeah, real gospel forgiveness.
The causes of, I guess, like actual repentance, like to turn away and recognize what led to it in the first place.
Yeah.
What needs to change and all that.
Real gospel repentance, restoration, forgiveness, grace is beautiful and it's powerful, but it's not cheap.
Yeah.
It's not flippant.
Yeah.
It's something that's traditionally and biblically heavy mm-hmm. and weighty and somber and important.
And that, if I can jump in, that is what frustrates me so much about the whole, like, we'll just give Trump a mulligan on this.
Yeah.
I feel like that is cheap grace.
Yeah.
That is not, his supporters are not holding him to a standard of repentance.
Yeah.
They're just saying it's fine because of these other reasons.
Well, I don't know if I want to say this right now or say it to the end. No, I'll say it now. If you followed any of this stuff with the Nassar trial and the gymnast doctor guy.
Just headlines and stuff.
Yeah, like just, a doctor abused a bunch of children who were entrusted to him. And there's been this whole thing where in his sentencing, all the victims were given an opportunity to face him and to make a statement. And it was this whole deal, and he like requested to not have to listen to the statements, and they were like, nope, you have to be in there, you have to face them, you have to listen to it. And one of the gymnasts gave, I think it was the last statement, but it's just insanely powerful. I'm trying to remember her name. I have this note here in front of me. Rachel Den Hollander. Was, I believe, the last person to speak. But I think she exemplifies what we're talking about in a really beautiful way. So she was a victim. She was abused in awful, horrible ways. But she's also a believer. And so she stands in this courtroom. She engages this guy. And there's a whole drama to it where the guy was like kind of trying to like play into faith and like the idea of redemption and like carrying a Bible into the courtroom with him during this part of the trial and those things. But she spoke these, you can read her statement online, but she spoke these really brutal and heavy words to the guy, but in a way that I think is really gospel. And I think representative of what the Bible actually teaches about grace and redemption. I'm going to read just like a really short excerpt from this, but you guys should look it up and read about it. She says, she's looking the guy in the face and she says, I pray you experience the soul-crushing weight of guilt so that you may someday experience true repentance and true forgiveness from God, which you need far more than forgiveness from me, though I extend that to you as well. This idea where like, I mean, she was looking her abuser in the face and offering him the biblical gospel grace of Christ, the redemption that says, no one is too far gone to receive the love of Jesus. And at the same time, she was unflinchingly holding him to account for the weight of his actions and his choices.
That's it.
And that's not cheap grace.
Yeah, that's it. Oh, man. The comment about the Bible. Have you read the book Just Mercy?
Mm-mm.
Have you heard of it?
Mm-mm.
By Brian Stevenson. He's heads up the Equal Justice Initiative, which does a lot of work with disfavored and incarcerated people, representing them legally, especially a lot of people that were innocent or disproportionately sentenced. And he goes through telling his stories and different cases he was involved in. There is one story of this young black teenager in the Deep South who was put on death row to be executed. And I forget if he was innocent or if it was like just something that most people weren't executed for. There was some unfairness in how he got there to begin with, especially as like a teenager.
Yeah.
And he was too short to like reach the shackles on the chair. So the only book they had was a Bible. And so he had to carry the Bible to his chair and sit on the Bible while they executed him.
Oh my gosh.
And it's like, that is just such a searing image of like the incongruence between like that like personal biblical morality and like the interpersonal like blindness.
Yeah.
Something I forgot to mention about Carl Ellis's talk was he talked about the same section of the country known as the Bible Belt was the same section where Jim Crow and all this discrimination persisted. This coexistence of like personal biblical morality with the blindness towards like how we treated, like it's like the whole love the Lord your God with all your heart is the greatest commandment, and the second is love your neighbor as yourself.
Yeah.
Like you can't really have one without the other.
Dude, that conflict is something that's really personal to me, that like hits really close to home. So like, you know this, but I have my ordination through the Southern Baptist Church, which is a really weird thing. The Southern Baptist Church literally exists because Baptists wanted, like there was a group of Baptists that wanted to justify slavery. They wanted to justify human slavery. And so they broke off from the denomination. They split from the worldwide rest of the denomination to say, well, we're going to keep being Baptists and own slaves. But then, you know, now, whatever, 150 years later, the denomination does all these amazing things. They have one of the largest mobilized mission forces on the planet. I mean, huge. The IMB is one of, I mean, it's an amazing organization that does all sorts of wonderful things to serve people who are hurting and declare the gospel all over the planet. And yet it's connected to this organization that literally was birthed out of a desire to justify slavery.
Yeah, but that's redemption.
Yeah.
Right? Like,
yeah. But that sits in this weird place with me of looking at that and going, that's in my own faith tradition, that inconsistency. And by the grace of God, I think the denomination's in a heck of a lot better than it was back then. But it's still like that's such a weird thing to even think about.
Yeah. I think a lot about the love your neighbor as yourself paradigm. Like, and I've been doing some study with cross references in the Bible and how there's a lot of connections with in Zechariah and Isaiah, and then also in the New Testament with people that were loving the Lord but not loving their neighbor, and God like trying to wake them up about that. But like, because sometimes I feel like in my most cynical moments that like our like secular liberal generation friends are like have more of an attitude to love their neighbors than like some of our evangelical forebears.
Yep.
But then I also feel like, then if I want to be cynical about them, I feel like they want, like without the foundation of Christ, it's not the same. And that like, and this is super generalizations here, but like a lot of people want to love their neighbor, but not love the neighbor as themselves.
Yeah.
Like, oh yeah, let's help poor people. Let's feed them, let's meet their needs, and let's tax rich people to do it. Like, don't tax me to do it. Like, let's welcome refugees, let's welcome immigrants and help them out and everything, but don't ask them to, like, come and my house. Like, don't ask me to go volunteer and teach them English. Like, let's bring them here, but don't make me sacrifice for it.
Yeah.
Like, and but then there's also people that there's also I know Christians that are loving their neighbors as themselves and sacrificing for those things, and that's like to me the beauty of the gospel.
Yeah. I have you read The Abolition of Man by C.S. Lewis?
Ooh, I don't think so.
So he,
not yet.
He it's really short. He has this whole argument he builds in there about how basically subjective ethics don't work, and how like in order for you to have any sense of ethics, like you have to have a baseline of like absolute truths about things. It's really cool. You should read it. It's a really cool progression, mental progression he builds, and you can poke some holes in it, but there's also some really cool truth in it. But he talks about that idea how the modern ethical systems that are built up that are divorced from like the understanding of absolute spiritual truths will always fall short. He basically talks about how like he gives this analogy where he calls an ethical system a window by which you see the world, and the only benefit to a window is that it's transparent and that you can see the backyard. But if you make the backyard transparent, then the window is pointless. So like he talks about how like your ethical system at some point has to hit something solid. It has to hit something that's actually universally true, or that it just won't work. It won't actually benefit anything. And I think to some extent, like I think that's an example of what we're seeing is, in my mind, the modern, no, modern's not the right word. I think the predominant ethical system that I see in like our generation, right, of like young Western liberal thinking folks, like it comes back to this generalized ethic of consent. Like things are about like creating bargains that can best benefit both parties or whatever. And that works itself out in a myriad of ways, from our sexual ethics to our business ethics to our social ethics. But I think this idea of like consent and mutual benefit, it, like we've tried to make that a baseline, and it's a baseline that doesn't work. It ends up ringing hollow, like you said. Like it falls short. And that may be like really naive for me to say it that way and really reductionistic, but it seems hollow to me. It doesn't feel meaty the way I think a robust, like organized, not even Christian, but like spiritual ethic does. That makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think what I would say is like the secular culture is basically trying to figure that out.
Yeah.
Seeing if they can figure it out.
Yeah.
And like there's Andy, you know, talked to us about the Jordan Petersons and the Sam Harris's, you know, debating this kind of stuff, and there's people pushing back on Me Too, saying that the consent ethic taken to its extreme leads to ridiculous outcomes, and can you have a real coexistence of like pursue all your sexual pleasure only all up until the point that it interferes with someone else's desires? Like, can you in practice?
Oh, you almost set your microphone tumbling.
Yeah. You know, can you on the one hand tell people that yes, they can always satisfy their sexual desires as much as possible, but then also as soon as if there's any lack of consent, you need to keep it inside and not satisfy in that instance and respect the other person? And you know, is that impracticality any different than abstinence education, which the same people say doesn't work?
Yeah.
I
feel like the whole consent, how it works out in our sexual ethics, I think that's like a specific discussion that I want to say something about. But I want to back up real quick, because I feel like if Andy's listening, he probably was beating his head against the wall when I was talking a minute ago. Just because he talked to us about that, right? Like the whole Peterson and like the secular Harris, and like he talked to us the moral landscape and a secular basis for ethics. And I'm pretty sure what I just said 5 minutes ago was, yeah, I know people do that, but it just feels really hollow to me.
Yeah, well, that's why.
But it does. I'm sorry, Andy. Well, it does.
That's
it
why
feels
I was. That's
why
I was saying.
Lacking to me.
My position is not whether it's lacking or not, but that the secular culture is trying to figure out if it's lacking or not.
Yeah.
And like, and this kind of speaks too to the shall we say evolution of morality in America, that the church is not really a part of this conversation anymore.
Yeah.
It's like it's different subgroups of secular culture kind of having this debate of like, what does practical consent ethics mean and how does that work? And, you know, you have Sam Harris type morality, and then you have, you know, Jordan Peterson type arguing that that doesn't work and that there are foundational truths from Judeo-Christian values that we need to keep. And trying to figure out if we can keep them in a non actually Christian culture, and
would
how
you,
to preserve
would you
them.
Up Abolition of Man and tell what you think.
Yeah,
because like, you can read it literally in a night. It's
like
3 chapters long.
Yeah, it's just kind of like an open question right now that, like, where our society is trying to figure out how to love their neighbors in a consistent way without Christ. And I think it's really fascinating, and I'm not going to say one way or the other, like.
Can I just
how it'll work or not.
Speak confessionally then?
Yeah.
I think, and this might just be a confession of my own weakness, I think I need the absolute values and truths of like a Christian ethics system to not be a dirtbag. I think I do. Like that, and I think that comes out in what I just said, that I was like, I don't know, man, like, it just feels squishy and feels hollow to me. Like, I think that's really what it is. Like, I think I need something solid to say, like, this is true, this is right, this is wrong, and to lean into that. And maybe I'm selling myself short, and maybe I'm way worse of a person than I think I am, but I think that's true. I really do.
Again, within the secular culture, there's debates going back and forth about, like, these gray areas and how to define them, and like that's an example of part of like what the secular culture is trying to figure out, what's okay and what's not okay. But I just think in general, like it's playing out, like that kind of stuff is playing out, and the church isn't really a part of it.
Yeah,
it's really interesting. Like I think this, I do want to say, I think the strongest thing that the secular culture has to offer us as Christians is the power dynamic element of it.
Yep.
Like, I feel like a lot of times in Christian sexual ethics, we focus so much just on like two people and what they're doing or not doing and when they should do it or not. And we totally don't acknowledge or talk very much about the power aspect.
Yeah.
And how like someone in a position of power has like implicit and explicit like influence and ability to like especially men in power with women under them, and how that creates dynamics where they feel less able to resist, and how, you know, that leads to so much abuse and things, and maybe it's partially because like there's traditional Christian ethics that men should be in power as heads, you know, different things like that. And this kind of gets into some of the patriarchy abuse stuff that we've talked a little bit about. But I feel like that's something actually positive that this kind of feminist movement has to offer for Christians, is to try to take a stronger recognition of just the temptations and role of power. To be aware of that and to try to guard against it and prevent those kinds of things.
Yeah, I think that's a really good thought. You talked earlier about how just this idea that the church just isn't in the conversation. And I think socially, in a lot of ways, it's just understood that the church has lost its credentials for this conversation because of the Catholic sex abuse and because of the way that's worked out in evangelical world also, you know, your Ted Haggards and your people like that. Like, I think there's just a lot of thought that, like, well, the church obviously doesn't have its act together with this stuff, so what could they have to speak into the conversation that would be beneficial? And the thing I think is a bummer about that is, man, there are large parts of the church that are doing awesome things for this conversation, that are seeking to see abuse destroyed and seeking to see people empowered and seeking to have a correct understanding of grace and justice. And those voices from within the church aren't being highlighted and aren't being drawn into the discussion in a way that I wish they were.
Do you have anyone we can highlight?
Yes, I do. There's an organization based out of here, out of St. Louis here, called Win the Saints. It's run by a guy named David Paterka.
Win, and like win, lose, or win, like win, where, who?
Like Win the Saints,
go marching. Right.
Yeah. Win the Saints. And they're specifically centered around ending sexual abuse and human trafficking on both sides of the equation. And so they run a safe house in Malawi, Africa, where they rescue girls from who've been trafficked, and they have a whole process of rehabilitation and counseling and empowerment and life training and for those girls, and they have a process to help them reacclimate to their community and learn actual marketable skills to get them out of the sex trade. And they also have a process of accountability and counseling and restoration for the men and women who are actually the traffickers, where they like work to see them prosecuted for their crimes and then work with them to do personal counseling to help them honestly like own the weight of what they've done and change their life and not be traffickers anymore and engage in things that are productive to society. And that's stinking powerful. Like, it's this beautiful mixture of calling abuse and corruption of power out for what it is and seeking to see consequences owned while also seeking freedom and redemption and a better way of life and a better society for everyone involved. It's really cool.
Boom.
And that sort of stuff is happening. Like, there are probably 10 other organizations just based out of St. Louis that are doing similar work around the world and in our community. But they're not the ones, they're not the voices that are being heard. We're hearing about High Point Church in Nashville and things like that. So that, you know.
Stupid internet.
Yeah. You got anything else, man?
Nope.
Well, you want to do a thing of the week?
Nope, what's our time? Thing of the week.
1:10, but I'm going to cut some stuff.
Yeah.
So one of my personal goals for this year is to read more. And I've been reading a lot of C.S. Lewis. And I read a book this month that is famous because C.S. Lewis is famous and most of his books are famous. Duh. But I read...
He's like the third most important Christian ever.
Yeah, I mean, basically, you have Jesus and then Paul and then C.S. Lewis, right?
I was going to say Billy Graham.
Oh, yeah. What about... Never mind. We don't talk about that. Anyway, I read The Great Divorce by C.S. Lewis, and it's a really, really good book. Have you read that one yet, Josh?
Yeah, it's been a while.
It's what I love. I think Lewis is at his best when he is telling stories because he's a storyteller and he has a way of conveying deep, deep truths about the human experience and about interpersonal relationships and about theology through story. And I think The Great Divorce is one of his best examples of that. It's the story of a dude who visits hell and then visits heaven.
Takes a bus ride.
Yeah, he takes a bus from hell to heaven with all these ghosts who have come from hell to visit heaven. And the story is broken up into a series of conversations where different saints who are in heaven come to meet these ghosts who've come to visit from hell and invite them to stay. Basically, that's where, see, we talked about this in our episodes on hell. C.S. Lewis has the famous line where he talks about how hell's doors are locked from the inside, that no one is in hell except people who want to be there. And the story is broken up of basically these saints who are experiencing perfection in heaven trying to convince these ghosts who are experiencing hell that they should stay in heaven, and they don't want to. And they're arguing back and forth, and it's broken up into all these dialogues, and it's
Is that biblical, Sam?
It's so good. It's not in any way biblical, but
Lewis gets a pass.
Yeah. Well, the truth, because he's not trying to make a statement about heaven and hell. He's trying to make a statement about what things absorb our love and our heart and our attention. Like, he's not trying to create a theology of the afterlife or limbo or any of those things. What he's pointing out is that lots and lots and lots of people think they have focused their heart and their person around the things of Jesus and the things of eternity, and they haven't. And it's really, really cool. My favorite scene is a discussion between two Anglican pastors, and one is in hell and one is in heaven. And there's a point where the saint goes, what I'm telling you is I want you to repent and believe. And the pastor looks at him and he goes, yes, but what is belief? And he just keeps like theologizing everything the guy says until it doesn't mean anything. And then his friend finally goes, I just desperately want you to stay here with me. And he goes, I'd really love to, but I have this Bible study down in hell that I have to lead, and I don't want to be late to it. And then he leaves and goes back to hell. And the image of it is humorous, but it was really good for me. But anywho, you guys should read The Great Divorce. It's a short book, easy to get into.
Yep.
You got anything else, man?
Nope.
Cool. Well, shout out to Kingly. Guys, thanks for letting us use your awesome music on our crappy podcast. You know we desperately need this. All right, man. Well, on that note, I guess I'm going to go read. I don't have anything. Dang it. I'm going to go read. Dang it. On that note, I'm going to go to a True Love Waits conference because I'm a heretic.
I'm going to go read a book by Tim LaHaye about what happens after America decays too much because I'm a good Christian.
The remix. Okay.